from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a huge day for the United Kingdom. Good or bad remains to be seen. Today, after their Brexit vote last summer, the British have formally filed for a divorce from the European Union. Under the EU's never-before-used Article 50, now come negotiations over how this unfolds. As in many divorces, they will be tough and consequential. This hour on Point, the Brexit divorce. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see coming for the UK, the EU, the US watching on? Today in Parliament, British Prime Minister Theresa May announced that she had triggered Article 50, the formal withdrawal from the EU.
Today, the government acts on the democratic will of the British people. And it acts too on the clear and convincing position of this House. A few minutes ago in Brussels, the United Kingdom's permanent representative to the EU handed a letter to the President of the European Council on my behalf, confirming the government's decision to invoke Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union.
Mixed feelings all around. In London, former UK Independence Party head Nigel Farage said he's thrilled that Brexit has formally begun.
We passed the point of no return. There'll be lots of arguments and debates over the next 2 years, but we are leaving. So I couldn't be happier, really.
In Brussels, European Council President Donald Tusk announced that he had received the letter, the formal letter, triggering Article 50 from Prime Minister Theresa May.
There is no reason to pretend that this is a happy day, neither in Brussels nor in London. After all, most Europeans, including almost half the British voters, wish that we would stay together, not drift apart. As for me, I will not pretend that I'm happy today.
We're going to look this hour at what lies ahead. Joining me first today from London is Roy Broomfield, a longtime champion of Brexit, director of the Freedom Association and of the Better Off Out campaign, which for 10 years advocated for the United Kingdom's exit from the European Union. Roy Broomfield, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Your sentiments on this day when it's formally done, or at least the negotiations begun?
Well, I'm very happy. I don't know what Donald Tusk is talking about. I think the British people also should be happy about the road that lies ahead, because today has marked the official start of a process where the United Kingdom will be leaving the political and legal institutions of the European Union that has held us back for so long.
You've championed this. In your view, why is this a good thing?
Well, it's a good thing. I remember last year saying that it's democracy. It's democracy, Tom, on your show. Mm-hmm. And I still maintain that. Making our own decisions, making our own laws, electing our own individual politicians, and then firing them if they don't get it right. These are good things for the United Kingdom. To free itself from an institution that doesn't respect those is ultimately a great thing. And to make our mark on the world, to go out and make free trade deals with other countries around the world independently, countries like the US, like Canada, like Australia, friends in India and elsewhere, this is a great day with great possibilities for the United Kingdom.
Lots of apprehension and some high expectations in some quarters about what lies ahead economically. What is the challenge now for the UK in the negotiations with the EU? What will really be on the table, Rory?
Well, what will be on the table? We have a trade deficit with the European Union, a very large trade deficit, whereby we import a lot of goods from the European Union, those be it German cars or French wine or a whole range of other goods. But of course, we sell a lot of financial services to the EU. But the good thing for the UK is that those financial services are really global. And we've talked about this for many years now, but I think the UK is in a great position, as highlighted in a pamphlet I wrote with Ian Murray of the Competitive Enterprise Institute called Cutting the Gordian Knot, to take the challenge and the road ahead and really make ourselves a globally competitive nation again.
You've got a trade deficit, but it's also your biggest market. If Europe drives a hard bargain, will you have access, full access to that market, the EU, the Europe?
Well, I'm confident we will have access to the EU and certainly access in goods because, as I just mentioned, we buy more from them as they sell from us. And with regards to financial services, the markets for financial services, whether it be in rates or financial exchange or a whole range of other services that are provided in London, the market is in London. And so if the European Union won't to negotiate in good faith and that there were trade cutoffs or tariffs put on financial services, they would only be hurting their own banks, their own businesses, their own customers, because the markets of which these are traded in are based in London. They're not in Frankfurt, they're not in Paris, they're not in Bucharest, they're in London, and they're in London for a reason.
Will they stay there without being in the EU? Will they stay there or drift toward the continent?
Well, I'm confident on the basis that London has the infrastructure, London has the capital, human capital and otherwise. It also has a global reach. Now, this is something that other European nations just do not have. And with the Brexit negotiations ongoing, the United Kingdom could restructure itself to be much more globally competitive and therefore be a much more attractive player with regards to financial services than our EU counterparts.
Your Prime Minister Theresa May has indicated that if the negotiations over how this Brexit proceeds don't go well, she might ditch the negotiations and just walk away. What would provoke her? What might provoke the UK to do that?
Well, there are a number of things on the table. So, for example, the European Union is threatening the United Kingdom, it seems, or so is read in the press, with a bill to be served to the UK on exiting the EU. So this bill banded around, say, 50 billion euros or so is something that they're talking about. Now, that I don't believe is realistic.
That's for what you owe into pensions and other obligations there, they say.
So they say, yes. But of course, the UK, the United Kingdom, has been almost investing in the EU's infrastructure for many years now. And so we would have assets within the European Union that we would look to realize on that particular occurrence. So I think the EU is looking to play a strong arm, and it's the start of a negotiation. But of course, I don't believe that's a realistic demand with regards to the formal structures, because ultimately, the EU needs, and the EU member states that make up the European Union, trade very favorably with the United Kingdom, very good terms, and it's in both countries' best interests to have a mutually shared relationship going forward, a positive relationship. Ultimately, the UK wants to be globally orientated, but Europe is part of the globe.
Lots of Britons travel and live on the continent, in Europe. Will they be able to continue to do that on the other side of the Brexit negotiations? Or will they have to have visas and so on like somebody from outside the EU?
That's a very good question, Tom. It's one of Theresa May, the British Prime Minister's, priorities to ensure that UK citizens have their rights respected in Europe, as with EU citizens have their rights respected in the United Kingdom. This is part of what is dubbed the Lancaster House speech, which he gave a couple of months ago, laying out the UK's approach to negotiations and what it wishes to ensure. So from the UK's perspective, we want to ensure that the rights and freedoms of individuals, both British on the continent and both EU citizens in the UK, are respected going forward.
What about the integrity of the United Kingdom itself? Scotland making noises about looking at breaking away again because they don't want to lose access, in part because they don't want to lose access to the EU. Ireland not entirely happy with the way all this in Northern Ireland, the difficulties there may evolve out of this as well. Could the UK end up disintegrating on the other side of this?
Well, I don't believe that to be the case. The reason why I don't believe it to be the case is because there are huge Brexit benefits that come from leaving the European Union, and that's some which I hope will be realized in the not-too-distant future. For example, farming and fishing rights, which have been given over to the European Union since we were becoming members of the EU, will now return to the United Kingdom and quite possibly will be devolved to Scotland, where they will have the ability to reframe regulations and laws concerning those two industries. And as an island nation, of course, fishing rights is something you would expect to have control over. And so we'll be taking back control over a whole range of policy areas to reshape and remake laws and regulations to benefit those in the United Kingdom and hopefully, as a result, make the UK stronger and more united going forward into the world.
What about the populace of the United Kingdom in the years to come? Many have observed that this seemed to be a no small part about immigration and large numbers coming in from across Europe and beyond, and Britain's responding some badly to that, not liking that. Does the UK become more, I don't know, or less diverse in the years ahead? Is this a kind of nativism, nationalism? What's unfolding here, Rory?
Well, I certainly hope it won't become less diverse. I think the United Kingdom benefits as a global hub for investment, as well as a global hub for talented individuals to come to the United Kingdom and contribute to our economy, as well as, of course, the global economy. The idea that we would be setting very restrictive quotas, I think can be unwound because ultimately the European Union puts an obligation on us in a way to have these barriers for non-EU nationals. Now we can have a much more meritocratic system where, as laid out in my pamphlet, Cutting the Gordian Knot, we could have an immigration system where it's nationality neutral. And so if you're from outside the European Union with the talents and possibilities, you can, and skills, you can contribute to the United Kingdom in a way that you can't currently.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the reality of the Brexit, Britain's negotiation over its exit from the European Union beginning today. They're in the formal divorce period now. The divorce papers are filed in Brussels. You can join us this hour. How do you look at all this? What's at stake for the UK, for the US, Europe, the world? Do you have a personal stake in this, a business stake in this? What is it? And what do you think drove 52% of British voters to say yes to Brexit, no to the EU? Will they get what they wanted from Brexit? At what cost? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Here it was last summer, Jenny Watson, chief counting officer, announcing the final tally of the Brexit vote. This was in June.
The total number of votes cast in favour of leave was 17,410,742. This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Yeah! It's been a bitter pill for opponents in the UK and many in the EU watching on. In January, here was Netherlands Prime Minister Mark Rutte talking about Brexit and the EU, whether they'd make it difficult for the UK to leave. Here was his response.
I don't hope so. I mean, it is the right of the UK to trigger this famous Article 50 to leave the EU. I'm totally and fundamentally against them doing it, but it is their sovereign right.
It is their sovereign right. Here, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker on Friday.
For me, it is a tragedy. I'm everything but in an hostile mood when it comes to Britain. We'll negotiate in a friendly way, in a firm way, and we are not naive.
We'll negotiate in a friendly way, but there's a lot on the line here. Talking with CNN Money last week, this is European Economic Commissioner Pierre Moscovici saying the EU would not offer the UK any favours in negotiations to come.
We believe that we have to defend our own interests that may defend the British interest. We believe that being a member of the EU and being out is not the same and cannot be as good.
We want to look at what's coming now. With us from Brussels is Ryan Heath, senior correspondent for Politico in Europe. Ryan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with me in the studio is Douglas Alexander, former UK Shadow Foreign Secretary from 2011 to 2015, former British Labour Member of Parliament, now a senior fellow at Harvard's Future of Diplomacy Project. Douglas Alexander, thank you very much for being with us.
It's good to be here, Tom.
Rory Broomfield, we heard from there. He campaigned a long time for this. He's happy today. You were not in favor of Brexit. Your thoughts, your sentiments, I guess, is we'll get into the details of what negotiations come, but What are you feeling as it's actually done now? Article 50 triggered.
I feel an overwhelming sense of sadness today. I want my kids, my children, to grow up in a world where we find shared solutions to shared problems. And I'm simply not convinced that whether it is prosperity, security, meeting the challenge of climate change or a whole counterterrorism, a whole range of other challenges that we face, that we're better equipped to face those challenges apart rather than together. And so it represents a day of sadness, and I look forward with some anxiety.
Mr. Broomfield said this is an expression. It was an expression of democracy. This is Britain saying we want a different way. We want to feel more democratic control over our lives.
I think that's a fair observation. I think there were probably two different kinds of voters who came together to deliver that vote of about 17 million voters in favour of Brexit. Some of them were motivated by sovereignty, a desire for British politicians to make British laws and then be judged by British judges. But there was also a significant number of immigration voters, voters who interpreted that phrase, take back control, as meaning control of Britain's borders. And in that sense, of course, there was a democratic decision reached by the British people last June, but the consequences of that choice are only now beginning to become apparent. And my real fear today, as the divorce papers are filed, is that some of the happy talk that we heard in your last interview is going to give way to some very hard negotiations about finances, about influence, about future relationships. And while Britain remains formally a member of the European Union during this two-year period of negotiation, there remains very real uncertainties as to what will be both the terms of the divorce and what will be the future relationship between Britain and the other 27 members.
We'll look at what you see, Douglas Alexander, as happy talk. Ryan Heath, there in Brussels, describe for us the challenges ahead in these negotiations. Well, it's a two-year clock running now, Ryan, and what has to be settled there and what makes it so, by nearly all accounts, so challenging?
Well, it's not just the negotiations. It's also the ratification of anything that's agreed that has to happen now within the next 2 years, unless and until all of the 28 EU countries, or sorry, the 27, agree that there can be an extension to that time clock. And what's going to be difficult there is that the EU would much prefer if there could be an arrangement on, I guess, the bar tab, the settlement that the UK needs to make before it's allowed out the exit door.
Is this the cash settlement you're talking about, Ryan? The sort of upfront 50 or 60 billion euros?
Yeah, that's the informal calculation that's emerging from the EU side, but there are various interpretations about what should be included in that number and what's fair, and then what's also politically realistic. I was at something called the Brussels Forum last week, a senior foreign policy and security policymakers forum, and 96% of the people that we polled in a room of 300 in the Brexit discussion that I was moderating thought that Theresa May couldn't turn up with a bill of more than 50 billion euros and to have it accepted to the British public. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth over that before we can really get into the meat of what the future relationship should be. Now, the EU might be legally correct that you can't negotiate the future relationship until those other matters are settled, but we're in uncharted waters here. So politically, what's going to have to happen is there will have to be some kind of parallel negotiation, because the UK can't be expected to make other commitments financially or in terms of citizens' rights without also having some sense of what is coming next. I think realistically, Theresa May has effectively given a speech today where she wants it all. You know, she wants the deepest, biggest ever trade agreement, but she doesn't want to make any of the compromises around freedom of movement that ordinarily would come with that for the EU. She wants the closest, most committed partnership, but she doesn't want to do it from inside the tent. So I think there's going to have to be compromises on both sides. Otherwise, there won't be any deal to speak of when we get to the end of the 2 years.
Douglas Alexander, what's Europe worried about looking on here? If they make too kind a deal as Europe leaves, other EU members may be tempted to go as well.
I think that's a very fair point, Tom. I mean, much of the coverage of Brexit since that hugely consequential vote last June in Britain has been based on a kind of peculiarly British conceit that as the British government, Theresa May can dictate the terms of Britain's departure. And I think, as your question suggests, we've got to recognise there are politics on both sides of the English Channel. And if you are Donald Tusk, the President of the European Council, if you're Michel Barnier, the lead European Commission negotiator, you are determined to ensure that Britain ends up with a worse deal, really for two reasons. First
worse
of all,
deal than it had
a worse deal than
tent,
it has as a full member, mm-hmm. exactly. For two reasons. Firstly, you've got a genuine and deep-seated fear of contagion. The idea that if Britain gets a great deal, doesn't have to pay all of the costs of membership, but retains full access to the single market, mm-hmm. ends free movement of labour, but has all the additional benefits of European membership, then we'll see other countries making the same choice. And I think as people from the United Kingdom, we underestimate at our peril the attachment of European political leaders to the idea of Europe as a common European home. So there's a genuine fear of contagion. There's also a genuine fear of populism. We've got hugely important French presidential elections mm-hmm. taking place later next month and then again in early May in the second round. Mm-hmm. We've got German federal elections coming up in the autumn. Not only will that probably delay serious negotiations until about 6 months' time, but it also means that European negotiators are determined not to do anything to fuel the wave of populism that they see gave rise to the Brexit vote in the first place.
What would fuel it? Further fuel it, I should say.
A sense that breaking up the European Union is economically and politically beneficial to individual countries. If you look at Marie Le Pen, she was hugely effusive in her response to the Brexit vote last June. There are many European politicians who are deeply fearful that positive signals and positive outcomes for the Brexit negotiations could actually assist the kind of nationalists, the xenophobes and the populists who have been on the rise in recent years in Europe.
Here's Marine Le Pen, of course, the National Front in France, very conservative, populist there, saying that the EU would look to be tough on Britain. This is an interview today with the BBC, Marine Le Pen saying that's undeniably the intention of the EU. They want the divorce to be as painful as possible. That's simply because they feel that other nations of Europe want to leave. They don't want a domino effect. Ryan Heath in Brussels, how acute is that fear of a domino effect? Britain as first in exiting, but not last.
It's really a split personality that is dealing with this possibility of a domino effect. You've got, at one level, the EU27 more united than people expected as a result of the UK referendum vote in 2016. And so they're committed to a particular approach to trying to fight back populism, to trying to deal in a responsible way in this negotiation. So that's the good side. That's the side that says, OK, a domino effect isn't coming. On the other hand, there is a genuine risk to Marine Le Pen being elected in France next month. We saw a lot of hyperventilation around Geert Wilders and the Dutch elections. I don't think it was ever realistic that he would lead a government in the Netherlands. In a sense, he was able to win or be one of the winners of that election by dominating the debate, by pulling the strings of some of the other party leaders. But he was never going to get into government. We cannot be certain that that would happen with Marine Le Pen in France. And if you have one of those twin motors of the European project really just completely leave the party in an even more aggressive and difficult way than the UK is about to leave, then you can really see the whole EU unraveling. It's not so much a domino effect as a kind of implosion if Marine Le Pen wins. And so people are working on the basis that she's unlikely to win, but she is really factored into those thoughts more than she was, let's say, 6-12 months ago.
Vladimir Putin maybe seeking that kind of implosion. Donald Trump has spoken sort of both ways about the EU. Ryan Heath in Brussels, Douglas Alexander, former Shadow Foreign Secretary of the UK, with me in the studio. Stand by. Lots of callers here. Catherine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see here?
Well, I'm, you know, the two previous callers mentioned exactly, the two previous interviews mentioned exactly what I was going to say. If I'm looking at this from a French point of view, it is a disastrous encouragement for Marine Le Pen, who I really would not like to win the elections. And that's pretty much my comment. I'm afraid she's very happy. I'm looking at the Guardian article on her today, and she's just thrilled. You know, she says, now it's her long live freedom, now it's our turn. And Marine Le Pen is somebody who's totally anti-immigration, and it terrifies me. So that's what I wanted to say.
Catherine, I appreciate your call. What odds, Douglas Alexander, that the EU ends up facing, you know, really seriously concerned about a disintegration beyond the Brexit?
I think if Marine Le Pen was to be elected later this year, then you would see a fundamental disintegration of the Europe that we've known over the last 40 to 60 years. I wouldn't place the likelihood of Marine Le Pen winning mm-hmm. beyond about 30 or 35%. Mm-hmm. But listen, we've witnessed some pretty significant events in the last 12 yes. months that people put at about 30 or 35%, whether it be the election of Donald Trump, whether it be the Brexit vote itself. And in that sense, the anxiety is profound across Europe that the Brexit negotiations could be of assistance to Marine Le Pen. Just to give your listeners a sense of why that matters, it was the French that gave the world the distinction between left and right. It was where people sat in the French yeah. National Assembly after yeah. the French Revolution. Mm. Marie Le Pen discards left and right politics. She says the battle is no longer between left and right. It is between globalisers and nationalists. And she defines herself as being on the same side as the Brexiteers in Britain and as Donald Trump here in the United States, defined against a global elite who she argues have mishandled the judgments that they've made over recent decades and are incapable of representing the best interests of the French people. So for her, Brexit's not a side issue. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely fundamental to the offer that she is making to the French people in the coming weeks before the election next month.
Ryan Heath, do you hear Europeans talking about these negotiations as fundamentally an economic issue? Or at bottom, is this about a set of Western values, which they see shared and at stake?
It's more towards the value end of that proposition, but I think it's even more a little existential for continental Europeans. Maybe not so much for younger generations that take the elements of European integration for granted, but the EU is fundamentally a peace project. It has a level of prosperity via its single market layered on top of it or woven into it now. But at the end of the day, there are still millions of people who understand what it's like to live with war or the consequences of war. And the EU is bound together in very tight-knit ways that aren't obvious from the written words or to outsiders. And we saw this in projects like the Eurozone when that got really tough going in 2011 and 2012, where the EU is never stronger than when it thinks its survival is at stake. And it tends to get its act together and it tends to fight back in ways that are unexpected. So I don't think people are really motivated by that idea of the single market bringing them 1% or 2% extra GDP. It's something a little bit more elemental and fundamental than that. And of course, that does overlap with that values question, but that's still a little bit abstract. There's a gut feeling that most leaders have, which is that Europe needs this union, otherwise there are darker days ahead, and that will really motivate them in the coming talks.
Rory Broomfield said earlier in this hour, Douglas Alexander, that it's going to be coming up all roses economically for the UK on the other side of this. They can go out into the world, do deals all over, sort of unleash, I don't know, the British animal spirits and thrive. How do you look at that?
Well, I've been a trade negotiator because I was the British Minister for Trade when I was in the UK Parliament. And mm-hmm. trade negotiations involve a combination of psychology and arithmetic. Psychology in terms of that animal spirit and the openness to trade, but arithmetic in the sense of a very carefully calibrated judgment as to how much strength you bring to the negotiations. If you are the European Commission negotiating on behalf of 500 million European consumers, you get a different engagement from the Chinese representing 1.4 billion consumers than if you're 65 or 70 million British citizens. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you know, the first challenge for the British trade policy will be to replicate the 60 or so international trade deals that the European Union has done while Britain has been a member of the European Union. And we bring less to the table, despite being about the fifth largest economy in the world, in those negotiations than we did in Europe. I have to say, I'm pretty sceptical of the point he was making. If you look at Germany's success as an exporting nation, they haven't been inhibited in their animal spirits by membership of the European Union. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, there's a basic formula for trade policy. Largely, as you double distance, you have trade. And Britain isn't going to escape the geographic reality that we continue to be proximate to the European continent. People talk a lot about doing trade deals with Australia, with yeah. Canada, with the United States, New Zealand. New Zealand has a smaller economy than Greece, one of the weakest economies within the European Union. And in that sense, I think there's going to be a tough challenge for European negotiators and British negotiators in the months ahead to try and sustain even the levels of trade we've had to date.
This On Point podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the reality of Brexit. Britain's negotiation over its exit from the European Union begins essentially today. The divorce papers are filed in Brussels. Ryan Heath, senior correspondent for Political Europe, joins us from Brussels today via Skype. Douglas Alexander is with us, former British Labour Member of Parliament, former Minister of Trade, former Shadow Foreign Secretary for the UK, with me in the studio. You can join us as well. What do you see here? What is won and what is lost as the UK leaves? What does it mean as countries pull away from one another? Are there shared values that survive the divorce? And what about the economics of all this? In Brussels today, European Council President Donald Tusk said the European Union, paradoxically, may be more determined to hang together here. Maybe.
Paradoxically, there is also something positive in Brexit. Brexit has made us, the community of 27, more determined and more united than before.
But the European Council President sad as well to see the UK going.
What can I add to this? We already miss you. Thank you and goodbye.
We already miss you. Thank you and goodbye. Last summer, the day after the vote in June, at the Glastonbury Festival in Edinburgh, young British subject talked to the International Business Times. Kind of mixed feelings. It was 52% to 48% losers. Not all happy here.
I don't agree with it at all. I think we should have stayed. I think it would have been better, like, for us as a country and that. I think it's a lot of, like, I think the younger generation think that a lot more. It's the older generation that sort of wants it out.
Douglas Alexander, Ryan Heath, please stand by. Lots of callers and questions for you. Andrew in Thompson, Pennsylvania. Andrew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. I've been watching the evolution of the EU for about 60 years now, and Britain has always been a reluctant dragon as far as being a membership in the EU. It resisted many of the changes and that took place over the decades. It seems now that everybody has forgotten the reason why the EU was created. It was basically to stop the rise of nationalism, which caused two great world wars, and also to create an economy that would rival the Soviet Union and the United States. All of that has succeeded until now. And it seems like 70 years later, we've forgotten all about that. And the rise of nationalism is back again, and Europe is, in Britain has forgotten that about this and still mourns the loss of its empire. Thank you.
Yeah, Andrew, I appreciate your call. Douglas Alexander, what do you see as the driver here? And what about the sense that Europe still may have it, but the UK clearly 52%. So, well, yes, unity makes us bigger, stronger, but we're done.
Well, I think Andrew makes a very fair point, which is the original rationale for Europe, which was peace on a continent that had twice been devastated by war in the 20th century, mm-hmm. is moving from memory to history. Mm-hmm. And so people's perceptions mm-hmm. of Europe have changed. And I think there's really three core arguments that make sense of the European idea. Firstly, peace. Secondly, prosperity with a single market. But thirdly, power. In a world with countries the size of continents, the United States, China, whether Europe is going to be in any way really influential on the international stage in part was based on whether Europe could come together and work as one. So I think that rationale continues to exist. But if you were an unemployed steelworker in Sunderland, one of mm-hmm. the key early results in the Brexit vote last June, you weren't thinking in terms of geopolitics or geoeconomics. I think actually there were three factors that came together to explain that 52% vote. Mm. It was partly a sense of economic anger, the stagnation that we've seen in real wages in Britain over recent years. It was partly cultural anxiety, a sense that the country and communities have changed faster than people anticipated and felt they had been consulted about. And thirdly, deep political alienation, particularly after the financial crisis, a hatred, and I use that word advisedly, of elected politicians, of bankers, of the elites. And if you bring together economic anger, cultural anxiety, political alienation, you saw what transpired, which was 52% of the public willing to vote to leave the European Union.
Ryan Heath, in Brussels, do you see the European authorities, the European bureaucracy, leaders changing in response to what happened with the UK? Are they morphing? Are they taking some lessons on board or sort of digging in to say, this is the way we do it?
Yes, I would say that there is a strong recognition that things have to change in Brussels. But as with most public institutions, they're slower, they're more flat-footed than some of the more nimble expressions of anger on online platforms or other more flexible organizations. So Douglas was completely correct in how that 52% coalesced. But I think there is an extra factor that is true in Britain, but also elsewhere, which is that the EU has never been very good at explaining itself. It's never had that enthusiasm factor. It's kind of a little bit like what Hillary Clinton's campaign experienced, but not over a few months, over decades, and probably on steroids, where it's never really been able to generate that enthusiasm because it's so removed from the everyday reality of so many people. Sitting in a few boardrooms in Brussels negotiating very technical rules and other systems of governance, it's not how most people want to spend their days organizing their life. And that makes it very difficult for the EU to cut through. And at a time, I worked as a spokesperson for the EU. So I've been on both sides of this fence, telling the stories about the EU, but also trying to make people interested in it. And I can tell you, it's very difficult. Aside from an effort I was involved in to end mobile roaming charges, there was very little that I could have explained to my own grandmother about what the EU does. And there's only so long you can go on like that before somebody really pulls the system up and shakes it and says that's not how it should be.
How does the EU bring something to match the hot-blooded thrum of nationalism, Douglas?
I think Ryan's point's very well taken. I mean, I remember when I was the Europe Minister for the United Kingdom having this conversation with one of my officials as to why the European Union was quite as unpopular as it was even at that stage with the British public. And he said, listen, the defining image of Europe for most people watching their televisions in Britain are politicians stepping out of limousines in Brussels and going into a conference room. He said, can you think of anything less popular than a politician's club? And that's a pretty fair observation. And actually, I think with the best of intentions, the European Union has made some missteps trying to address that problem. So we've got a European flag, a European anthem. I think the effect of those in the minds of many British citizens, certainly, has not been to create a sense of emotional connection to the institutions of the European Union. It's been to further their suspicion that this is a half-built European superstate. And actually, people want to feel a sense of belonging and emotional affinity to their nation rather than to a supranational institution like the European Union.
Is it doomed then, or is there another way of carrying it, of exercising it?
Well, I think there needs to be humility on the part of the European Union. You know, the traditional way that Europe deals with a crisis is crisis, chaos, and suboptimal outcome. Mm. And in that sense, I think the standard answer, which is just, listen, the answer to every problem is more Europe, is not adequate in the face of the scepticism people fear. I think there are some basic changes that could be made. I think the establishment of the European Parliament was intended to create a democratic accountability for the institutions of the European Union. I don't think it's worked. Most people across Europe simply could not name who their members of the European Parliament are and suspect that they're wasting money on the citizens' behalf. I think it would be much better to go back to the original system, which is to say a certain number of members of the British Parliament, a certain number of members of the German Parliament, the French Parliament, the other national parliaments should gather on a regular basis, if you like, to reconnect the politics of the European Union to the domestic politics of the countries involved. And I think while it was, as I say, well-intentioned to create the European Parliament, I don't think it's diminished the democratic deficit. I think it's actually increased people's suspicions.
Let's go to Dennis in Mooresville, North Carolina. Dennis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. My daughter and her husband live in England. She's an American,
yeah,
but is now a legal alien there. Mm-hmm. And one of their big concerns about this, and they were not supporters of Brexit, I might add,
mm-hmm,
is that there'll be retaliation from the EU members with travel visas, because they both like to travel throughout Europe. They go to Italy and to Spain and to France,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and they like to travel all over Europe. But what if the EU starts to retaliate in kind of, I would call, a petty fashion and restrict travel a little bit and make it a little more difficult? Is that a possibility?
Let us pick it up. Ryan Heath, what do you say?
I think it's unlikely. It's probably citizens who will bear the least brunt, if it's possible. I think that politicians from all of the 28 current EU countries are aware there's potential backlash if they make people's lives visibly difficult. You're much more likely to see friction when it comes to the trade in goods rather than the movement of people, I would say. It's a little bit different when it comes to people's ability to reside in other EU countries. But no one really wants to get in the way of a weekend away, because there will be some price to pay electorally for that.
Arnold in New Orleans, Louisiana. Arnold, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My comment is that here in the United States, we've got a big country. We have states and and different states have their regulations and all that. But as an individual, I could go up to North Dakota if I needed a job, you know, when there's the oil boom up there.
Yep.
I could go to New England. I can go to California.
Yep.
And in Europe, there was that kind of a situation. A young English person could go any place where there was a job if there was not a good economy in their locality. And I think that's going to really hurt the young people of England when the Brexit does happen.
Douglas Alexander, what about the freedom to not only travel, but to live and work all over Europe for Britons now?
Well, one of the biggest divides in Britain when the vote took place last June was between the young and the old, because young people in Britain overwhelmingly voted to stay part of the European Union, partly because they are the EasyJet generation. They're the Ryanair generation who have been used to being able to travel, whether for a weekend or to study on an Erasmus scheme that allows them to interrail or to study in other parts
just
of Europe.
Just go. Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think, as Ryan said, it's probably going to be one of the areas that is less controversial than others. I sincerely hope so, as a mm-hmm. British citizen, as a father of two British kids. But on the other hand, the reality that was part and parcel of an integrated Europe is real. And in that sense, we're going to have to renegotiate all of these issues over the coming 2 years in a way that for the last 40 years or so, there was a sense that this was settled and it was just part of the way the world was developing.
Chris in New Haven, Connecticut. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'm both a U.S. and a French citizen. I have a small business, international business, partly based in Connecticut and partly based in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm likely to have to move my business from Edinburgh to Paris. But perhaps more importantly, I really think that one of the previous speakers was overly dismissive about the notion of the Scottish leaving the Great Britain. It was unlike many, the initial Brexit, the initial vote for Scottish independence a few years back was unlike most elections, where there's a segment of people who aren't really caring, who aren't paying attention, who are not reading the newspapers. Everyone cared, absolutely everyone. And the people who didn't vote were absolutely on the fence. And I had the right to vote, and I didn't vote, and because I was going to vote for independence, and then a couple English friends at the last minute.
For Scotland, and many people, Chris, we've got it, many people talking about that again now. Scotland may want to keep that EU link. And it was, as you are alluding to, it was only yesterday the Scottish Parliament voted to back a bid for a second referendum on independence from the UK. Here's Nicola Sturgeon, First Minister of Scotland, during the debate.
The people of Scotland should have the right to choose between Brexit, possibly a very hard Brexit, or becoming an independent country, able to chart our own course and create a true partnership of equals across these islands.
Douglas Alexander, we hear the little bit of Scottish in you, or more than a little bit.
More than a little bit Scottish in me, Tom.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about it? Do you see the UK holding together under these 2 years, and maybe Scotland deciding to go its own way?
Well, it was just 30 months ago, in September 2014, that as Scots we voted by a clear margin of 10 percentage points from 45 to 55 to stay within the United Kingdom. We were told at the time by the Scottish Nationalists, by Nicola Sturgeon amongst them, that this was a once-in-a-generation opportunity. But 30 months on, they're using the pretext of the Brexit vote to say they want a second referendum on independence. The indications are that the majority of the Scottish people are not convinced that we need or want a referendum right now. And actually, if anything, the economics of independence have got worse in the intervening 30 months. We've seen a collapse in the oil price internationally.
Yep.
And at the same time, we're in circumstances where Scotland exports four times as many goods to the British single market than the European single market. So if you're a nationalist who will use any excuse to try and further your aim of independence, you're now in the curious position of saying it is a disaster to leave the European single market, but it's not a disaster to leave the British single market to whom we sell four times as much. So the economics point towards Scotland staying within the UK. But as the Brexit vote itself last June indicated, politics is about a lot more than economics. It's not simply about facts, it's also about feelings. And in that sense, what we are now witnessing is the Scottish National Party working hard every day to build a sense of grievance, to create a sense that Britain after Brexit is no longer hospitable to Scots who voted, as we did, overwhelmingly to stay within the European Union. So the risk is real, but I think it's far from certain that Scotland is going to choose independence in the years ahead.
We've got under a minute. Your hope, your fear as the UK starts this process?
My hope is that we will see as close a relationship between Britain outside the European Union and the members of the European Union as can be achieved during the coming 2 years of negotiation. My fear is that the happy talk that we've heard from the Brexiteers collapses under the weight of hard negotiations, and that many of the people who in sincerity voted, they believe, to improve their economic prospects by voting for Brexit end up being bitterly disappointed by the new barriers, the new borders, the new tariffs that would otherwise follow.
Ryan Heath, 20 seconds. A hard Brexit coming here. Europe showing some steel as the UK looks to go.
Yes, the EU is going to be clinical and Theresa May has to watch her back. What's difficult here is that no one really proposed or promised or asked for a hard Brexit, but that's what Theresa May is pushing for. It's going to be difficult for her to sustain.
Ryan Heath, senior correspondent for Politico Europe, with us today from Brussels. Ryan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Douglas Alexander with me here in the studio, former trade minister, former British Labour member of Parliament, and shadow foreign secretary for the UK. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.